KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, a series sponsored by Northwest Film Center. October 2nd through November 5th are the dates. While cinema provides entertainment and escape for many committed filmmakers and viewers, it's a vital medium of engagement and a powerful tool for social action. Films in the series include 50 Feet from Syria, Dreamcatcher, No Land's Song, and We Come as Friends. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film from October 2nd to November 5th at the Northwest Film Center in the Whitzel Auditorium of the Portland Art Museum, located at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue here in Portland. More information about films and screening times can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now we will go to economist Richard Wolff.
I am very, very pleased to introduce to you my guest, Harry Konstantinidis. Harry, I've known him for years. He's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. But he is also a person of Greek background, intimately involved with and knowledgeable about the developments in Greece for the last period of time. His primary research interests lie in political economy, with particular emphasis on agriculture and the environment, and with a broad focus both on Greece, but Greece in the context of the European situation. So, Harry, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Greece is a small country, 11 million people. That 11 million is not only the number of people in Greece, but it's the number of destructive diesel cars that the VW Corporation dumped on the world. That's interesting because the Germans were in the forefront of explaining to the Greeks that they were immorally not working hard enough, immorally enjoying pensions earlier and more generous than they ought to have gotten, and a whole lot of other crimes of moral inadequacy. This was being done by a country that was failing at the time to control the pollution of the entire continent of Europe and other continents too, by producing illegally and marketing fraudulently automobiles that they had designed to evade pollution control and emissions control. It's a very interesting example of what we called, when I was growing up, a case of the pot calling the kettle black. Whose morals are in question? Who's got the authority to wave their finger at who else? But anyway, we'll come back to that. In 2008, global capitalism collapsed. A small country like Greece couldn't possibly be held accountable for causing this event. Greece, like many other small countries, was a victim, and its participation minimal. What its politicians had done, indeed, like so many politicians, was to solve many of its problems by borrowing money rather than coming up with other solutions that would have been better. But that's not unique to the Greek government. Every other government, the United States included, does this. But when the crisis hit, the Greeks had a hard time paying back their debts, and they wanted, therefore, to get the debts relieved. They wanted debt relief, like debtors in trouble always do. Like the people of Detroit tried to do to cope with the crisis of Detroit, like the people of Puerto Rico, as we reported last week, are struggling to do now, the Greeks wanted to relieve their debt. The Europeans, led by the Germans, basically wouldn't allow it and demanded that the Greeks not only pay off their debt, but that they use money that they had before used to pay salaries to public employees, to operate their public services, that money be cut back, the employees deprived of parts of their salaries, the public services destroyed, public property of the government sold off, and to use the money instead to pay the creditors, both Greek wealthy creditors and European wealthy creditors. There was a lot of struggle, which we've talked about. There was even a referendum where the majority of Greek people voted unambiguously that they don't want that. They don't think that's appropriate. I should add, not to take too much time, but that it is normal when a creditor lends to a debtor that we require of the creditor in all transactions to do what's called due diligence, to determine whether the borrower is capable of borrowing. The German banks, the French banks, the Greek banks all knew that the Greek government was borrowing a large sum of money, and that therefore, if there was economic difficulty, that borrower couldn't pay back. They made the decision, nonetheless, to take the risk, to charge high interest rates, to take the risk. Then, when the crisis came and the country can't pay it back, they weren't willing to admit that they had made a loan they probably shouldn't have made. And they didn't want to pay anything. They wanted all the burden to be on the borrower and none on the creditor, or very little on the creditor, even though the borrower was in terrible shape. That's where we stand. We've had the decision by the Greek people, not only in a referendum to say we hate this, but even more profound, the decision of the Greek people to throw out of office the two parties that had basically dominated Greek politics for decades, the Greek Socialist Party and the New Democracy Party, which used to together get two-thirds of the vote, now can barely get one-third of the vote, and a new marginal corner of the spectrum, a left-wing small party, Syriza, has become the dominant party in Greek politics. So you see the anger and the resentment of the people, but they still now, because of what has happened, because of the use of the power of money and the banks to have any money to run the Greek economy, despite the referendum and despite the political changes, basically where they are today is facing a mountain of debt and having an economy that has shrunk over recent years, that is actually predicted to shrink over the next year or two, even with some help from Europe. And the amount of that help is not yet clear. So I want to begin, Harry, by saying, in this awful story of what is being done savagely to one small corner of Europe, let's begin by your telling me, what has this meant for the people of Greece, for the average man, woman, child, school kid, worker? What is it? And you know this not only because you're a student of all of this, but your family's Greek, you're Greek, etc.
Yes. So the consequences of austerity are really hard to describe. It's really hard to actually explain the magnitude of the disaster that the austerity policies have caused on the average Greek household. To start a little bit with the numbers, right? The unemployment rate in Greece used to be 7 to 8% before the crisis started. By 2010, before the austerity packages were put in place, the unemployment rate went up to approximately 12%. And after the rescue packages, the austerity packages, started being implemented, the unemployment rate has skyrocketed to 27, 28%. This is not capturing the fact that a significant number of Greek people have emigrated over the last 5 years. Essentially, approximately, if I'm not mistaken, 200,000 people are trying to leave Greece every year. And this mostly revolves around the people who are the youngest, the educated, the most productive young people of Greece. The unemployment rate among people who are below 25 years is approximately 60%. This means that 3 out of 5 young workers under 25 are unable to contribute, they're unable to be productive, they're unable to work. Homelessness has skyrocketed. Only between 2009 and 2011, it increased by approximately 25%. So if you walk around the streets of Athens, you're going to see a lot of people sleeping on the streets, people who were living in homes before and who lost these homes because of the changes in austerity. Maybe they lost their jobs, and maybe the eviction laws based on this, implemented by virtue of the structural adjustment programs, made them go on the street, be on the street.
By the way, let me just interject for my Yes. American audience and for the world audience. In the depths of the American Depression of the 1930s, unemployment peaked in 1933 at 25%. So you're basically telling us that the conditions in Greece over the last few years are worse than the worst time in the greatest depression of American capitalism.
If I'm not mistaken, I saw last year a graph in the New York Times comparing the Great Depression to the U.S. to the Greek crisis right now, and that was last year. If we were in the Great Depression, we would have already recovered. Given the projections that project that Greece is going to be in a worse depression for the next 3 years, there is no end to this. And there's no end to this. The more that we implement more of these disastrous austerity policies that kill the patient, right? So the austerity package, the austerity packages now, we're in the third austerity package, were supposed to cure the problems of the Greek economy, and instead they are killing the Greek patient right now.
Okay, so now let me ask you the difficult questions.
Yes.
Based on all of this. Thank you very much. Many people around the world are wondering, as I know Greeks are themselves wondering, given the referendum that was almost, if I remember, 60% or so against austerity, given that the Syriza party became the dominant party by being in principle against austerity, we know that the pressure of the Germans and the rest of the Europeans made Alex Tsipras and the Syriza party change their position and accept the austerity that they had opposed. I don't want to go into what the calculations were that made him and his party do that. What I want to understand is, how do you see the situation now, given all of this? What is the goal of the government now? How is it going to get Greece out of this disaster of having to pay off mountains of debt and crunching and destroying its own economy and thereby kind of worsening the situation? Tell us what possible way out might be here and how you assess it.
I think there are a couple of calculations here. The first calculation is that Greece, if it behaves and if the Syriza government plays by the rules, will get debt relief, right? So the first calculation that I think parts of the Syriza leadership made over the summer is that if they play along, they may get something in exchange for more austerity. I think this is a disastrous calculation. I think this is...
You think it's disastrous because they won't get this relief? Or the relief won't make a difference if they do get it?
I think that debt relief won't make a difference. I think that...
Even if they get it?
Yes. I think that the terms of debt relief that are, you know, being mentioned in the press as potential schemes are not going to make a significant change. So one of the schemes that was basically proposed was that if Greece... There will be a cap on the payments, on the repayments of debt every year that Greece is going to be making. So I think I saw a proposal where 15% of Greek GDP would go for payments towards the debt. That's a huge number. And it's not clear that the Greek payments are of the order of 15%. So it's like offering you something that you're not going to hit anyway. So that doesn't really make a difference for the day-to-day operations of the Greek economy.
And the Europeans, if the Greeks don't deliver these payments, then even the relief, because it'll be trickled out, won't continue.
That's the other thing.
Here, at least they threaten that.
So here we have a relationship of power, right? So the way that the negotiations have been proceeding, we have seen the power structure of Europe, we have seen the power structure of the Eurozone. Well, in the case of Greece versus the lenders, it's Greece that has to perform and the lenders then reward the good or the bad. Right. But even though the Greek crisis and even though the problems of the Greek public debt are not really a making of the Greek economy only and of the Greek policymakers only, even though there's an intimate involvement of the German and the French banks, for example, for the ballooning of the Greek debt before
right.
2010, even though the Greek state was a major buyer of German arms, right? So to give you an example, because I don't think many people know this, in the 2000s, Greece was the highest spender in terms of military expenditure in the European Union. Among all
as
the
a percentage
as
of
a
the
percentage
GDP.
Of GDP.
Right.
Among all European countries, Greece was spending the highest amount of money to buy arms, mostly from the US, Germany, and France. If you look at 2003, the military spending of Greece as a percentage of GDP is actually comparable to the US military spending for 2003. Now,
so then am I correct? One could say that the German and French banks lent to Greece the money that they knew would come back in payment for German and French arms.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look at the numbers, look at the current account balance of the Greek economy and the German economy between the 1999 to 2012 period of time. Essentially, the German banks were lending money to the Greek government that then the Greek government could use in order to buy arms from the German and the French bank, from the German and the French industries. So you have a very peculiar situation. Now, when the crisis hits, for reasons that, of course, go well beyond the interest of Greece, I mean, like, Greece does not cause the crisis. When the crisis hits, the Greek taxpayer is asked to pay the bill, right? And this is what we've been seeing over the last 5 years, that the Greek taxpayer has been suffering, the Greek household has been suffering, and the Greek economy has been plunged into a depression that there is no end to, the way that we have been going.
And yet, to get to the next big question, it seems that one of the reasons Tsipras gives for doing what he did is that the majority of Greeks, despite everything you've just said, don't want to leave this Eurozone that is crushing them. Can you help us understand this?
I think that when we're talking about the currency, right, and when we're thinking about money, some economists tend to be very narrow-minded when it comes to thinking about money, right? Money, yes, is perhaps a medium of exchange, but it does so many other things, right? Money is a symbol, and money is important to the way that we view the world. Money is important to the formation of our identity, right? So if I told you that all of a sudden you wouldn't be able to pay in dollars, but you would have to use the drachma, you may all of a sudden feel that you are threatened or that your identity is being challenged in very profound ways. And this is also important because the euro was seen as a sign of progress over the last 20 years or so. Finally, the Greek middle class was able to travel abroad and use the same currency when it was going on vacation in Paris that it was using when in Athens. So, symbolically speaking, the euro is considered a sign of modernity, a sign of progress, and a large number of the Greek population does not want to let go of that. Now, add to that the fact that we have not had a serious conversation in Greece about the economic implications of the eurozone. What does it mean to be in the eurozone, right? How does the eurozone promote this types of adjustment, of neoliberal restructuring that has been taking place in Greece over the last 5 years? How has the eurozone basically dictated the terms and has been asking Greece to privatize its water supply, to open up its electricity system so that, you know, like, private companies from Greece, but also mostly from abroad, are going in to buy these assets at very, very reduced prices, right? How has the eurozone basically dictated these terms that have affected this internal devaluation, is what we call it? Like,
the minimum, everything cheaper inside.
Making everything cheaper, which mostly means making wages fall. The minimum wage in Greece has fallen by approximately 30% over the last 5 years.
So what was it and what is it
the
now?
The minimum wage in Greece was 751 euros
per
month. Right, 751 euros per month, and I don't know if this translates, but the cost of living in Greece is not very low. I mean, I just saw a survey, actually, a study that basically says that the cost of living in Athens is approximately two-thirds of the cost of living in New York City. So this gives you a little bit of a sense right. as to whether you could live in New York City with $900 a month.
Right.
So the minimum wage fell from 751 euros to 586 euros within 2 years, within 3 years.
And for, there are a significant number of Greek workers who get the minimum
yes,
wage?
Yes, that's right. Yes. At this point, actually, it would be more correct to say that there is a significant number of workers who technically should be getting the minimum wage, but are not getting paid because their firms don't have any money, so they have them work without them getting paid. So workers are going to their jobs, they're reporting every day, and then at the end of the month, when the time comes to actually get your paycheck, you are told that the firm doesn't have any money, you should wait, right? So there are people...
So they're waiting in the hope that they get paid?
They are waiting in the hope that the firm is not going to go out of business. I have friends and relatives who have not been paid for 6 to 8 months. waiting that at some point the situation...
And what are they living from?
So this is where you have the family networks basically act as a safety mechanism that allows people to get by. This also tells you why the crisis has been much more dramatic in Athens, where the family networks are not as visible as opposed to the countryside.
Villages, yeah.
So in the countryside, I mean, I'm from a small place in the west of Greece. People have access to land, or the family networks are more important, and people can, you know, like, garden and grow some of their food. In Athens, you don't have these safety mechanisms, and this is why you have a much more pronounced crisis, a crisis that doesn't seem to be coming to an end the way that this has been developing.
I want to interject for a moment that people hearing this report, listening to you, have got to understand and see this as a cautionary tale about the future of the United States. Pay attention, folks, because this that you can't imagine happening here, the Greek people didn't imagine a few years ago that they would confront either. And they are now going through a level of deprivation that is absolutely one of the options. I'm not saying I can tell you it's going to happen. Of course, no one can. But is that a possibility? Absolutely. And part of the shift of capitalism to Asia, for example, and out of Europe, and demanding that the only way they're going to stay in Europe is if the wages come down so they can compete with the low wages of Asia. This is a problem that is happening in the United States as well. Each country will do it in its own way. But what we're hearing about Greece is a cautionary tale. It would be unwise not to pay attention to, Harry.
No, I think that's right. And I think there's definitely the argument that, you know, it's the workers' fault when the economy is not performing, right? Even though it was the banks that made these bad bets, and even though it was the arms industry that was benefiting from the public debt of the Greek government, we are then being told that it's the workers' turn to pay because they were lazy, they weren't, you know, like, productive enough, and it's time for them to accept reductions in their benefits, to accept reductions in their pensions, to accept reductions in health expenditure, educational expenditure that has, like, fallen to unprecedented, to dramatic levels in Greece. So it's a cautionary tale. And I would also add it's a cautionary tale about what happens when the political and economic system is hijacked by free market fundamentalists and also by people who believe that, you know, you always have to restrict the state spending or spending that eventually goes to workers, right? I would also want to draw the parallel between the Eurozone and some fractions, at least of the American political elite,
please, yeah,
who have been talking about public debt, for example. When the Greek crisis started approximately 2009-2010, and debt as a percentage of GDP was approximately at 120% of GDP. Right now, public debt as a percent of GDP is at 180% of GDP. Right, we have
so people. The situation has gotten worse.
The situation has gotten
under
worse.
The austerity that was supposed to fix
it. Right. So we have people running the Eurozone who are really obsessing about public debt. They really think that quantitative easing is a dangerous policy, and I do think we have certain fractions of the American political system, right? We know them, the Tea Party and significant parts of the Republican Party, that basically echo similar feelings and similar sentiments about how the state should fix its finances.
You know, it's a hallmark of the capitalist system. When things are going well, when the business cycle is on the upswing, we hear a great deal about, you know, innovations by entrepreneurs. And when the system is going down, we understand that workers are lazy, are not productive enough. It's, you know, when it's good, it's my responsibility. When it's bad, it's somebody else's. And the system teaches you how it pigeonholes people. And you can see that in Greece. It was very disheartening for me as a friend of Greece, but not Greek myself, to discover how many of the people I knew in Greece, instead of being angry and upset about what the Eurozone participation meant, we're actually turning on each other. Right. if they were private sector workers in Greece, they were blaming the public sector. If they were in business people, they were blaming the government. If they were the government and business, they were blaming the worker. It's sad. It's dividing up people who, if they got together, could actually change the situation.
That's right. And I think this is the lesson forward, right? I mean, at least for Greece, the lesson forward is that we have to think about challenging austerity, but also challenging what the capitalist system actually is and what it does. So this, to some extent, is the challenge for the Greek people. It's the challenge for the Syriza government going forward.
What do you think is going to happen? I know it's difficult, but you have a better sense of it than I do. And maybe our listeners will get something from your sense of where it's going.
I think there are certain fractions in Syriza that have different visions. And I think that Syriza is in need of a new narrative, because the old narrative that we would go to Europe and convince them that austerity is not working has failed. Austerity is working. Austerity is not a flaw. Austerity is not a mistake. Austerity has been working, not for restoring jobs, not for restoring growth, but
for smashing down the wages and the standard of living.
Precisely.
In order that eventually maybe the Greeks can go back to work, but at a completely lower standard of life than anything they expected or had assumed was in their future.
That's exactly right. And always thank your employer that you have a job every day that you go to work, right? So getting paid is not enough. You also have to be very, very thankful that you have a claim to a job, not to a claim to a salary. Now, the other thing that would be important to note is that it also means, you know, what do we do with firms that are going out of business? How are we going to turn things around? So if austerity has failed, how can we change the lives of people in their everyday settings? What are we going to do with firms that, you know, are going out of business? Are we going to turn them over to something different? Are we going to turn them over to a situation where if your boss can't pay you, well, maybe it's time for you to take over the firm. Mm-hmm. And the state would help you set up shop and work the firm as a co-op, as a self-managed enterprise, self-directed enterprise, or something else, right? How do we do our budgeting? How do we have participation in every aspect of everyday life? And that will also help us solve the questions of corruption. You know, if people knew where their public spending goes, they would probably not spend as much money for military expenditures. They would probably spend more money for schools, for hospitals, for things that we need in our everyday life. That's the challenge. That's what Syriza needs to do now. And they need to do it fast, because we don't really have much time.
Harry, thank you very, very much
thank
for
you
sharing
very much,
your
Rick.
Insights.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, this is the end of our program again. I want to remind you that we maintain two websites for your use, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. Please make use of them. You can follow us there on Twitter and Facebook. Just click on the icon. You can sign up for our free newsletter and follow us in that way and be contacted by us on a regular basis. We are also looking for new radio stations around the country to carry our program, the one you're just listening to.
And yes, that was economist Richard Wolff interviewing Professor Harry Konstantinidis. And you are going to want to stay tuned, because Chris Andre is in the wings getting ready for Air Cascadia. We are just a couple minutes before 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints. Today, a look at this past weekend's horrific bombing in Turkey. Also, an extended report on the battle of the so-called comfort women of Korea to have their suffering internationally recognized. At 11 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andresen and guest Jim Gilbert talk about planting garlic and cover crops. And after the rains come, and transplanting just about anything. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not yet a member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm, click on Donate today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hemp Stock Harvest Festival, October 17th and 18th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. Portland's annual Hemp Stock Harvest Festival in Portland, Oregon, advocates decriminalization of cannabis for medicinal, industrial, and recreational use. It will feature food vendors, guest speakers, and live music, including a performance by John Trudell and Bad Dog. Again, that's the Hemp Stock Harvest Festival, October 17th and 18th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.